Second Son. Chapter 1. On a hot August Thursday in 1974, an old man in Paris did something he had never done before. He woke up in the morning, but he didn't get out of bed. He couldn't. His name was Laurent Moutier, and he had felt pretty bad for 10 days, and really lousy for 7. His arms and legs felt thin and weak, and his chest felt like it was full of setting concrete. He knew what was happening. He had been a furniture repairman by trade, and he had become what customers sometimes brought him, a wormy old heirloom, weakened and rotted beyond hope. There was no single thing wrong with him. Everything was failing all at once. Nothing to be done. Inevitable. So he lay patient and wheezing, and waited for his housekeeper. She came in at 10 o'clock, and showed no great shock or surprise. Most of her clients were old, and they came and went with regularity. She called the doctor, and at one point, clearly in answer to a question about his age, Moutier heard her say 90 in a resigned yet satisfied way, a way that spoke volumes, as if it was a whole paragraph in one word. It reminded him of standing in his workshop, breathing in dust and glue and varnish, looking at some abject, crumbly cabinet, and saying, "Well now, let's see," when really his mind had already moved on to getting rid of it. A house call was arranged for later in the day. But then, as if to confirm the unspoken diagnosis, the housekeeper asked Moutier for his address book, so she could call his immediate family. Moutier had an address book, but no immediate family beyond his only daughter, Josephine. But even so, she filled most of the book by herself, because she moved a lot. Page after page was full of crossed-out box numbers and long, strange foreign phone numbers. The housekeeper dialed the last of them and heard the whine and echo of great distances, and then she heard a voice speaking English, a language she couldn't understand, so she hung up again. Moutier saw her dither for a moment, but then, as if to confirm the diagnosis once again, she left in search of the retired schoolteacher 2 floors below, a soft old man whom Moutier usually dismissed as practically a cretin. But then how good did a linguist need to be to translate "ton père va mourir" into "your father is going to die"? The housekeeper came back with the schoolteacher, both of them pink and flushed from the stairs, and the guy dialed the same long number over again and asked to speak to Josephine Moutier.
"No, Richard, you idiot," Moutier said, in a voice that should have been a roar, but in fact came out as a breathy, tubercular plea. "Her married name is Richard. They won't know who Josephine Moutier is."
The schoolteacher apologized and corrected himself and asked for Josephine Reacher. He listened for a moment and covered the receiver with his palm and looked at Moutier and asked,
What's her husband's name? Your son-in-law?" "Stan," Moutier said. "Not Stanley either. Just Stan. Stan is on his birth certificate. I saw it. He's Captain Stan Reacher of the United States Marine Corps."
The schoolteacher relayed that information and listened again. Then he hung up. He turned and said,
"They just left. Really just days ago, apparently. They were family. Captain Reacher has been posted elsewhere."
Chapter 2. The retired schoolteacher in Paris had been talking to a duty lieutenant at the Navy base on Guam in the Pacific, where Stan Reacher had been deployed for 3 months as Marine Corps liaison. That pleasant posting had come to an end, and he had been sent to Okinawa. His family had followed 3 days later, on a passenger plane, via Manila. His wife, Josephine, and his 2 sons, 15-year-old Joe and 13-year-old Jack. Josephine Reacher was a bright, spirited, energetic woman, at 44, still curious about the world and happy to be seeing so much of it, still tolerant of the ceaseless moves and the poor accommodations. Joe Reacher, at 15, was already almost full-grown, already well over 6 feet and well over 200 pounds, a giant next to his mother, but but still quiet and studious, still very much Clark Kent, not Superman. Jack Reacher, at 13, looked like an engineer's napkin sketch for something even bigger and even more ambitious, his huge, bony frame like the scaffolding around a major construction project. 6 more inches and a final 80 pounds of beef would finish the job, and they were all on their way. He had big hands and watchful eyes. He was quiet, like his brother, but not studious. Unlike his brother, he was always called by his last name only. No one knew why, but the family was Stan and Josie, Joe and Reacher, and it always had been. Stan met his family off the plane at Futinma Air Station, and they took a taxi to a bungalow he had found 1/2 mile from the beach. It was hot and still inside, and it fronted on a narrow concrete street with ditches either side. The street was dead straight and lined with small houses set close together, and at the end of it was a blue patch of ocean. By that point, the family had lived in maybe 40 different places, and the move-in routine was second nature. The boys found the second bedroom, and it was up to them to decide whether it needed cleaning. If so, they cleaned it themselves, and if not, they didn't. In this case, as usual, Joe found something to worry about, and Reacher found nothing. So he left Joe to it, and he headed for the kitchen, where first he got a drink of water, and then he got the bad news. Chapter 3. Reacher's parents were side by side at the kitchen counter, studying a letter his mother had carried all the way from Guam. Reacher had seen the envelope. It was something to do with the education system. His mother said, "You and Joe have to take a test before you start school here." Reacher said, "Why?" "Placement," his father said. "They need to know how well you're doing."
"Tell them we're doing fine. Tell them thanks but no thanks."
"For what?"
"Well, I'm happy where I am. I don't need to skip a grade. I'm sure Joe feels the same."
"You think this is about skipping a grade?"
"Isn't it?"
"No," his father said. "It's about holding you back a grade."
"Why would they do that?"
"New policy," his mother said. "You've had very fragmented schooling. They need to check you're ready to advance."
"They never did that before."
"That's why it's called a new policy, as opposed to an old policy."
"They want Joe to take a test? To prove he's ready for the next grade? He'll freak out."
"He'll do okay. He's good with tests."
"That's not the point, Mom. You know what he's like. He'll be insulted, so he'll make himself score 100% or 110. He'll drive himself nuts."
"Nobody can score 110%. It's not possible."
"Exactly. His head will explode."
"What about you?"
"Me? No, I'll be okay."
"Will you try hard?"
"What's the pass mark?"
50%, probably."
"Then I'll aim for 51. No point wasting effort. When is it?"
3 days from now, before the semester starts."
"Terrific,"
Reacher said.
"What kind of an education system doesn't know the meaning of a simple word like vacation?"
Chapter 4. Reacher went out to the concrete street and looked at the patch of ocean in the distance up ahead. The East China Sea, not the Pacific. The Pacific lay in the other direction. Okinawa was one of the Ryukyu Islands, and the Ryukyu Islands separated the two bodies of water. There were maybe 40 homes between Reacher and the water on the left-hand side of the street, and another 40 on the right. He figured the homes closer to him and further from the sea would be off-post housing for marine families, and the homes further from him and nearer the water would be locally owned by Japanese families who lived there full-time. He knew how real estate worked. Just steps to the beach. People competed for places like that, and generally the military let the locals have the best stuff. The DOD always worried about friction, especially on Okinawa. The air station was right in the center of Genowon, which was a fair-sized city. Every time a transport plane took off, the schools had to stop teaching for a minute or two because of the noise. He turned his back on the East China Sea and walked inland, past identical little houses, across a four-way junction, into a perfect rectilinear matrix of yet more identical houses. They had been built quick and cheap, but they were in good order. They were meticulously maintained. He saw small, doll-like local ladies on some of the porches. He nodded to them politely, but they all looked away. He saw no local Japanese kids. Maybe they were in school already. Maybe their semester had already started. He turned back, and 100 yards later found Joe out on the streets, looking for him. Joe said, "Did they tell you about the test?" Reacher nodded.
"No big deal."
"We have to pass."
"Obviously we'll pass."
"No, I mean we have to really pass this thing. We have to crush it. We have to knock it out of the park."
"Why?"
"They're trying to humiliate us, Reacher."
"Us? They don't even know us. People like us. Thousands of us. We have to humiliate them back. We have to make them embarrassed they even thought of this idea. We have to piss all over their stupid test."
"Well, I'm sure we will. How hard can it be?" Joe said, "It's a new policy, so it might be a new kind of test. There might be all kinds of new things in it."
"Like what? I have no idea. There could be anything."
"Well, I'll do my best with it."
"How's your general knowledge?"
I know that Mickey Mantle hit 303 10 years ago, and 285 15 years ago, and 300 20 years ago, which averages out to 296, which is remarkably close to his overall career average of 298, which has to mean something."
"They're not going to ask about Mickey Mantle."
"Who then?"
Joe said, "We need to know, and we have a right to know. We need to go up to that school and ask what's in this thing."
Reacher said,
"You can't do that with tests. That's kind of opposite to the point of tests, don't you think?
We're at least entitled to know what part or parts of which curriculum is being tested here.
It'll be reading and writing, adding and subtracting, maybe some dividing if we're lucky. You know the drill. Don't worry about it.
It's an insult." Reacher said nothing. Chapter 5. The Reacher brothers walked back together across the four-way junction and into the long concrete street. Their new place was ahead and on the left. In the distance, the sliver of sea glowed pale blue in the sun. There was a hint of white sand, maybe palm trees. Between their place and the sea, there were kids out on the street. All boys, Americans, black and white, maybe 2 dozen of them. Marine families, neighbors. They were clustered outside their own places at the cheap end of the street, 1,000 steps from the beach. Reacher said,
"Let's go take a look at the East China Sea."
Joe said, "I've seen it before. So have you."
"Hey, we could be freezing our butts off in Korea all winter."
"We were just on Guam. How much beach does a person need?"
"As much as a person can get. We have a test in 3 days."
"Exactly. So we don't have to worry about it today." Joe sighed, and they walked on, past their own place, toward the sliver of blue. Ahead of them, the other kids saw them coming. They got up off curbstones and stepped over ditches and kicked and scuffed their way to the middle of the road. They formed up in a loose arrowhead, facing front, arms folded, chests out, more than 20 guys, some of them as young as 10, some of them a year or two older than Joe. Welcome to the neighborhood. The point man was a thick-necked bruiser of about 16. He was smaller than Joe, but bigger than Reacher. He was wearing a core T-shirt and a ragged pair of khaki pants. He had fat hands, with knuckles that dipped in, not stuck out. He was 15 feet away, just waiting. Joe said quietly, "There are too many of them." Reacher said nothing. Joe said, "Don't start anything. I mean it. We'll deal with this later if we have to." Reacher smiled.
"You mean after the test?"
"You need to get serious about that test." They walked on. 40 different places, 40 different welcomes to 40 different neighborhoods. Except that the welcomes had not been different. They had all been the same. Tribalism, testosterone, hierarchies, all kinds of crazy instincts, tests of a different kind. Joe and Reacher stopped 6 feet from the bruiser and waited. The guy had a boil on his neck, and he smelled pretty bad. He said,
"You're the new kids."
Joe said, "How did you figure that out?"
"You weren't here yesterday."
"Outstanding deduction. You ever thought of a career with the FBI?
The bruiser didn't answer that. Reacher smiled. He figured he could land a left hook right on the boil, which would hurt like hell, probably. The bruiser said,
"You going to the beach?"
Joe said, "Is there a beach?"
"You know there's a beach."
"And you know where we're going."
"This is a toll road."
Joe said, "What?"
"You heard. You have to pay the toll."
"What's the toll?"
"I haven't decided yet," the bruiser said. "When I see what you've got, I'll know what to take."
Joe didn't answer. The guy said,
"Understand?"
Joe said, "Not even a little bit."
"That's because you're a retard. You two are the retard kids. We heard all about you. They're making you take the retard test because you're retards."
Reacher said,
"Joe, now that's an insult."
The big guy said,
"So, the little retard talks, does he?"
Joe said,
"You seen that new statue in the square in Luzon?"
"What about it?"
"The last kid who picked a fight with my brother is buried in the pedestal."
The guy looked at Reacher and said,
"That doesn't sound very nice. Are you a psycho retard?"
Reacher said, "What's that?"
It's like a psychopath."
"Oh, you mean do I think I'm right to do what I do and feel no remorse afterward?"
"I guess."
Reacher said,
"Then yes, I'm pretty much a psychopath."
Silence, except for a distant motorbike. Then two motorbikes. Then three. Distant, but approaching. The big kid's gaze jumped to the four-way junction at the top of the street. Behind him, the arrowhead formation broke up. Kids wandered back to the curbs and their front yards. A bike slowed and turned into the street and puttered slowly along. On it was a Marine in BDUs. No helmet. An NCO back from the base, his watch finished. He was followed by two more, one of them on a big Harley. Disciplinarian dads coming home. The big kid with the boil said,
"We'll finish this another time."
Joe said,
"Be careful what you wish for."
Reacher said nothing. Chapter 6. Stan Reacher was a quiet man by nature, and he was quieter than ever at breakfast on the fourth morning of his new command, which was turning out to be a tough gig. Back in the States, the presidency had changed hands a little prematurely, and the Joint Chiefs had scrambled to present the new guy with a full range of options for his review. Standard practice. The start of every new administration was the same. There were plans for every imaginable theoretical contingency, and they had all been dusted off. Vietnam was effectively over, Korea was a stalemate, Japan was an ally, the Soviet Union was the same as ever, so China was the new focus. There had been a lot of public hoo-ha about détente, but equally, there had been a lot of private planning for war. The Chinese were going to have to be beaten sooner or later, and Stan Reacher was going to have to play his part. He had been told so on his second morning. He had been given command of four rifle companies, and he had been handed a top-secret file defining their mission, which was to act as the tip of an immense spear that would land just north of Hangzhou and then punch through clockwise to isolate Shanghai. Tough duty. Casualty estimates were frightening, but ultimately a little pessimistic in Stan's opinion. He had met his men and he had been impressed. On Okinawa, it was always hard to avoid mental comparisons with the ghosts of the freak marine generation that had been there 30 years before, but the current crop was good, real good. They all shared Stan's personal allegiance to the famous old saying, "War is not about dying for your country, it's about making the other guy die for his." For the infantry, it all came down to simple arithmetic. If you could inflict 2 casualties for every 1 you took, you were ahead. If you could inflict 5, you were winning. 8 or 10, the prize was in the bag. And Stan felt his guys could do 8 or 10 easy. But China's population was immense and fanatical. They would keep on coming. Men, and then boys, women too, probably. Boys no older than his own sons, women like his wife. He watched them eat, and imagined husbands and fathers 1,000 miles away doing the same thing. A communist army would draft a kid Joe's age without a second thought, Reacher's age even, especially a big kid like that. And then the women, and then the girls. Not that Stan was either sentimental or conflicted, he would put a round through anyone's head and sleep like a baby, but these were strange times, that was for damn sure. Having kids made you think about the future, but being a combat marine made the future a theory, not a fact. He had no real plans for his sons. He wasn't that kind of a father. But he assumed they would stay military. What else did they know? In which case, Joe's brains would keep him safe. Not that there weren't plenty of smart guys on the front lines, but Joe wasn't a fighter. He was like a rifle built without a firing pin. He was all there physically, but there was no trigger in his head. He was like a nuclear launch console instead, full of are-you-really-sure fail-safes and interlocks and sequenced buttons. He thought too much. He did it quickly, for sure, but any kind of delay or hesitation was fatal at the start of a fight, even a split second. So privately, Stan figured Joe would end up in intelligence, and he figured he would do a pretty good job there. His second son was a whole different can of worms. The kid was going to be huge. He was going to be 1/8 of a ton of muscle, which was a frightening prospect. The kid had come home bruised and bloodied plenty of times, but as far as Stan knew, he hadn't actually lost a fight since he was about 5 years old. Maybe he had never lost a fight. He had no trigger either, but not in the same way as his big brother. Joe was permanently set to safe, and Reacher was permanently jammed wide open on full auto. When he was grown, he was going to be unstoppable, a force of nature, a nightmare for somebody. Not that he ever started anything. His mother had trained him early and well. Josie was smart about things like that. She had seen the danger coming, so she had taught him never, ever, ever to start trouble, but that it was perfectly okay to react if someone else started it first, which was a sight to see. The smart money brings a gun to a knife fight. Reacher brought a hydrogen bomb. But the kid could think, too. He wasn't academic like Joe, but he was practical. His IQ was probably about the same, but it was a get-the-job-done type of street-smart IQ, not any kind of for-the-sake-of-it cerebral indulgence. Reacher liked facts, for sure, and information, too, but not theory. He was a real-world character. Stan had no idea what the future held for the guy, no idea at all, except he was going to be too big to fit inside a tank or an airplane cockpit, so it was going to have to be something else. But anyway, the future was still far off for both of them. They were still kids. They were still just his fair-haired boys. Stan knew that, right then, Joe's horizons stretched no further than the start of the new semester, and Reacher's stretched no further than the 4th cup of coffee for breakfast, which the kid got up and poured right on cue. And also right on cue, Joe said, "I'm going to walk up to the school today and ask them about this test." "Negative on that," Stan said. "Why not?" "2 reasons. First, never let them see you sweat. Second, I put in a requisition form yesterday, and I'm expecting a delivery today."
"Of what?"
"A telephone."
"Mom will be here."
"I won't," Josie said.
I have errands to run.
All day?
Probably. I have to find a store cheap enough to feed you the 8 pounds of protein you seem to need at every meal. Then I have to go have lunch with the other mothers at the officers' club, which will probably tie me up all afternoon, if Okinawa is still the same as it was last time we were here, which it probably is.
Richard can wait home for the telephone, Joe said. He doesn't need a babysitter.
That's beside the point, Stan said. Go swimming, go play ball, go chase girls, but don't go ask about the test. Just do your best when it rolls around. Chapter 7. At that moment, it was very late the previous evening in Paris, and the retired schoolteacher was back on the phone with the Navy station on Guam. Laurent Moutier's housekeeper had whispered to him that they really ought to try to get hold of the old man's daughter, but the schoolteacher was getting nowhere. The duty lieutenant on Guam had no personal insight into the Pentagon's plans for China, but Stan Reacher's new posting was classified as secret, so no foreign citizen was going to hear a thing about it, not from the Navy, no sir, no way, no how. Moutier heard the audible half of the back and forth from his bed. He could understand English a little, enough to get by, and just enough to hear things between the lines. He knew exactly how the military worked. Like practically every other 20th century male in Europe, he had been in the service. He was already 30 years old when World War I broke out, but he volunteered immediately and survived all 4 years, Verdun and the Somme included, and he came out the other end with a chest full of medals and no scars longer than his middle finger, which was statistically the same thing as completely unscathed. On his day of demobilization, a lugubrious, one-armed, one-eyed brigadier wished him well, and then added, apropos of nothing,
"Mark my words, Moutier, a great war leaves a country with 3 armies, an army of cripples, an army of mourners, and an army of thieves."
And Moutier found all 3 immediately on his return to Paris. There were mourners everywhere, mothers, wives, fiancées, sisters, old men. Someone said that if you gave every dead soldier a 1-page obituary, just 1 lousy page, to list all his hopes and dreams, then the resulting pile of paper would still stand taller than the Eiffel Tower itself. Thieves were everywhere, some solo, some in mobs or gangs, some with a political tint, and Moutier saw cripples all day long, some in the natural course of events, but many more at work, because his furniture repair operation had been commandeered by the government and told to make wooden legs for the next 10 years. Which Moutier did, out of parts of tables bought up cheap from bankrupt restaurants. It was entirely possible there were veterans in Paris stumping around on the same furniture they had once dined off. The 10-year government contract expired a week before the Wall Street crash, and the next 10 years were hard, except that he met the woman who quickly became his wife, a beauty foolish enough to take on a battered 45-year-old wreck like him. And a year later, they had their only child, a mop-haired girl they called Josephine, who had grown up and married a Marine from New Hampshire in America, and who was currently completely uncontactable, despite the vast array of technological innovations Moutier had witnessed in his lifetime, many of them invented by the Americans themselves. Chapter 8. Stan Reacher pulled his field cap low and walked away to work. A minute later, Josie headed out shopping, with a big bag and a thin purse. Reacher sat on the curb, waiting for the kid with the boil to come out to play. Joe stayed inside, but not for long. 30 minutes later, he came out with combed hair and a jacket. He said, "I'm going to take a walk." "To the school?" Reacher asked. "Least said, soonest mended."
"They're not humiliating you. You're humiliating yourself. How does scoring 100% make you feel good when you already asked what the questions were?"
"It's a matter of principle."
"Not my principle," Reacher said. "My principle is they set these things so average people can pass them, which gives me enough of a chance that I don't feel I have to get my panties in a wad beforehand."
"You want people to think you're average?"
"I don't care what people think."
"You know you have to wait here for the delivery, right?"
"Yeah, I'll be here," Reacher said, "unless the fat, smelly kid comes out with so many friends I end up in the hospital."
"Nobody's coming out with anybody. They all went to a ball game. This morning, in a bus. I saw them. They'll be gone all day."
Chapter 9. The telephone delivery arrived while Reacher was eating lunch. He had made himself a cheese sandwich and a pot of coffee, and was halfway through both when the delivery guy knocked on the door. The guy unpacked the box himself and handed Reacher the phone. He said he had to keep the box. Apparently there was a shortage of boxes on the island. The phone was a weird instrument. It was like no phone Reacher had seen before. He put it on the countertop next to the remains of his sandwich and looked at it from all angles. It was definitely foreign and probably about 30 years old, from some beaten nation's wartime warehouses then. Mountains of stuff had been inherited. 100,000 typewriters here, 100,000 binoculars there, 100,000 telephones, rewired and reissued. At the right time, too, turning tents and Quonset huts all over the world into permanent brick and stone buildings must have put a lot of pressure on a lot of people. Why wait for Bell Labs or GE when you can just back up a truck to a warehouse in Frankfurt? Reacher found the jack on the kitchen wall and plugged in the phone and checked for a dial tone. It was there, so he left the phone on the countertop and headed out to the beach. Chapter 10. It was a great beach, better than most Reacher had seen. He took off his shirt and his shoes and took a long swim in warm blue water, and then he closed his eyes and lay in the sun until he was dry again. He opened his eyes and saw nothing but whiteout and glare from the sky. Then he blinked and turned his head and saw he was not alone. 15 feet away, a girl was lying on a towel. She was in a one-piece bathing suit. She was maybe 13 or 14. Not all grown up, but not a kid either. She had beads of water on her skin, and her hair was slick and heavy. Reacher stood up, all crusted with sand. He had no towel. He used his shirt to brush himself off, and then he shook it out and put it on. The girl turned her head and asked, "Where do you live?" Reacher pointed.
"Up the street," he said.
"Would you let me walk back with you?"
"Sure."
"Why?" "In case those boys are there."
"They're not. They're gone all day.
They might come back early."
"Did they give you that toll road crap?"
She nodded.
"I wouldn't pay."
"What did they want?"
"I don't want to tell you."
Reacher said nothing. The girl asked,
"What's your name?"
Reacher said,
"Reacher."
"Mine's Helen."
"I'm pleased to meet you, Helen."
"How long have you been here?"
"Since yesterday,"
Reacher said.
"You?"
"A week or so."
"Are you staying long?"
"Looks like it."
"You?"
"I'm not sure,"
Reacher said. The girl stood up and shook out her towel. She was a slender thing, small but long-legged. She had nail polish on her toes. They walked off the sand together and into the long concrete street. It was deserted up ahead. Reacher asked,
"Where's your house?"
Helen said,
"On the left, near the top. Mine's on the right. We're practically neighbors."
Reacher walked her all the way, but her mom was home by then, so he wasn't asked in. Helen smiled sweetly and said thanks, and Reacher crossed the street to his own place, where he found hot, still air and nobody home. So he just sat on the stoop and whiled away the time. 2 hours later, the three Marine NCOs came home on their motorbikes, followed by two more, then two more in cars. 30 minutes after that, a regular American school bus rolled in from the ball game, and a crowd of neighborhood kids spilled out and went inside their homes with nothing more than hard stares in Reacher's direction. Reacher stared back just as hard, but he didn't move, partly because he hadn't seen his target, which was strange. He looked all around, once, twice, and by the time the diesel smoke cleared, he was certain the fat, smelly kid with the boil had not been on the bus. Chapter 11. Eventually, Joe came home, silent and preoccupied and uncommunicative. He didn't say where he had been. He didn't say anything. He just headed for the kitchen, washed his hands, checked the new phone for a dial tone, and then went to take a shower, which was unusual for Joe at that time of day. Next in, surprisingly, was their father, also silent and preoccupied and uncommunicative. He got a glass of water, checked the phone for a dial tone, and holed up in the living room. Last in was their mother, struggling under the weight of packages and a bouquet of flowers the women's welcoming committee had produced at lunch. Reacher took the packages from her and carried them to the kitchen. She saw the new phone on the countertop and brightened a little. She never felt good until she had checked in with her dad and made sure he had her latest contact information. France was 7 hours behind Japan, which made it mid-morning there, which was a good time for a chat, so she dialed the long number and listened to it ring. She got the housekeeper, of course, and a minute later, the hot little house on Okinawa was in an uproar. Chapter 12. Stan Reacher got straight on the new phone to his company clerk, who leaned on a guy, who leaned on another guy, like dominoes, and within 30 minutes, Josie had a seat on the last civilian flight of the evening to Tokyo, and within 40, she had an onward connection to Paris. Reacher asked,
"Do you want company?"
His mother said,
"Of course I would like it, and I know your Grandpa Moutier would love to see you again, but I could be there a couple of weeks, more perhaps, and you have a test to take and then school to start." "They'll understand. I don't mind missing a couple of weeks, and I could take the test when I get back, or maybe they'll forget all about it."
His father said, "Your mother means we can't afford it, son. Plane tickets are expensive." And so were taxicabs, but 2 hours later they took one to the airport. An old Japanese guy showed up in a big boxy Datsun, and Stan got in the front, and Josie and the boys crowded together in the back. Josie had a small bag. Joe was clean from the shower, but his hair was no longer combed. It was back to its usual tousled mess. Reacher was still salty and sandy from the beach. No one said much of anything. Reacher remembered his grandfather pretty well. He had met him 3 times. He had a closet full of artificial limbs. Apparently the heirs of deceased veterans were still officially obliged to return the prostheses to the manufacturer for adjustment and eventual reissue, part of the deal from back in the day. Grandpa Moutier said every year or so another one would show up at his door, sometimes 2 or 3 a year. Some of them were made from table legs. They got out at the airport. It was dark and the air was going cold. Josie hugged Stan and kissed him, and she hugged Joe and kissed him, and she hugged Reacher and kissed him. And then she pulled him aside and whispered a long, urgent sentence in his ear. Then she went on alone to the check-in line. Stan and the boys went up a long outside staircase to the observation deck. There was a JAL 707 waiting on the tarmac, spotlit and whining and ringed with attendant vehicles. It had stairs rolled up to its forward door, and its engines were turning slowly. Beyond the runway was a nighttime view of the whole southern half of the island. Their long concrete street lay indistinguishable in the distance, miles away to the south and the west. There were 10,000 small fires burning in the neighborhood, backyard bonfires, each one flickering bright at its base, and sending thin plumes of smoke high in the air.
"Trash night," Stan said.
Reacher nodded. Every island he had ever been on had a garbage problem. Regulated once-a-week burning was the usual solution, for everything, including leftover food. Traditional, in every culture. The word bonfire came from bone fire. General knowledge. He had seen a small wire incinerator behind the hot little house.
"We missed it for this week," Stan said. "I wish we'd known."
"Doesn't matter," Joe said. "We don't really have any trash yet."
They waited, all three of them, leaning forward, elbows on a rail. And then Josie came out below them, one of about 30 passengers. She walked across the tarmac and turned at the bottom of the stairs and waved. Then she climbed up and into the plane, and she was lost to sight. Chapter 13 Stan and the boys watched the takeoff, watched the jet bank and climb, watched its tiny lights disappear, waited until its shattering noise was gone, and then they clattered down the long staircase, 3 abreast. They walked home, which was Stan's usual habit when Josie wasn't involved and the distance was less than 8 miles. 2 hours quick march, nothing at all to a Marine, and cheaper than the bus. He was a child of the Depression, not that his family's flinty New England parsimony would have been markedly different even in a time of plenty. Waste not, want not, make do and mend, don't make an exhibition of yourself. His own father had stopped buying new clothes at the age of 40, feeling that what he owned by that point would outlast him, and to gamble otherwise would be reckless extravagance. The bonfires were almost out when they arrived at their street. Layers of smoke hung in the air, and there was the smell of ash and scorched meat, even inside the hot little house. They went straight to bed under thin sheets, and 10 minutes later, all was silent. Chapter 14 Reacher slept badly, first dreaming about his grandfather, the ferocious old Frenchman somehow limbless and equipped with 4 table legs, moving and rearing like a piece of mobile furniture. Then he was woken in the early hours by something stealthy in the backyard, a cat or a rodent or some other kind of scavenger, and then again much later, when the new phone rang 2 times. Too soon for his mother to have arrived in Paris, too late for a report of a fatal accident en route to Tokyo. Something else, obviously, so he ignored it 2 times. Joe got up at that point, so Reacher took advantage of the solitude and rolled over and slept on, until after 9 o'clock, which was late for him. He found his father and his brother in the kitchen, both of them silent and strained, to a degree he found excessive. No question that Grandpa Moutier was a nice old guy, but any 90-year-old was by definition limited in the life expectancy department. No big surprise. The guy had to croak sometime. No one lives forever. And he had already beaten the odds. The guy was already about 20 years old when the Wright brothers flew, for God's sake. Reacher made his own coffee because he liked it stronger than the rest of his family. He made toast, poured cereal, ate, and drank. And still no one had spoken to him. Eventually, he asked, "What's up?" His father's gaze dipped and swiveled and traversed like an artillery piece and came to rest on a point on the tabletop about a foot in front of Reacher's plate. He said, "The phone this morning."
"Not Mom, right?"
"No, not that."
"Then what?"
"We're in trouble."
"What, all of us?"
"Me and Joe." Reacher asked,
"Why, what happened?"
But at that point the doorbell rang, so there was no answer. Neither Joe or his father looked like moving, so Reacher got up and headed for the hallway. It was the same delivery guy as the day before. He went through the same ritual. He unpacked a box and retained it, and handed Reacher a heavy spool of electric cable. There must have been 100 yards of it. The spool was the size of a car tire. The cable was for domestic wiring, like Romex, heavy and stiff, sheathed in gray plastic. The spool had a wire cutter attached to it by a short chain. Reacher left it on the hallway floor and headed back to the kitchen. He asked,
"Why do we need electric cable?"
"We don't," his father said. "I ordered boots."
"Well, you didn't get them. You got a spool of wire."
His father blew out a sigh of frustration. "Then someone made a mistake, didn't they?" Joe said nothing, which was very unusual. Normally, in that kind of a situation, he would immediately launch a series of speculative analyses, asking about the nature and format of the order codes, pointing out that numbers can be easily transposed, thinking out loud about how QWERTY keyboards put alphabetically remote letters side by side, and therefore how clumsy typists are always a quarter inch away from an inadvertent jump from, say, footwear to hardware. He had that kind of a brain. Everything needed an explanation. But he said nothing. He just sat there, completely mute.
"What's up?"
Reacher said again, in the silence.
"Nothing for you to worry about," his father said.
"It will be unless you two lighten up, which I guess you're not going to do any time soon, judging by the look of you."
"I lost a code book," his father said.
"A code book for what?"
"For an operation I might have to lead."
"China?"
"How did you know that?"
"Where else is left?"
"It's theoretical right now," his father said. "Just an option. But there are plans, of course. And it will be very embarrassing if they leak. We're supposed to be getting along with China now."
"Is there enough in the code book to make sense to anyone?"
"Easily. Real names, plus code equivalents for two separate cities, plus squads and divisions. A smart analyst could piece together where we're going, what we're going to do, and how many of us are coming."
"How big of a book is it?"
"It's a regular three-ring binder."
"Well, who had it last?" Reacher asked.
"Some planner," his father said, "but it's my responsibility."
"When did you know it was lost?"
"Last night. The call this morning was a negative result for the search I ordered."
"Not good," Reacher said. "But why is Joe involved?"
"He isn't. That's a separate issue. That was the other call this morning. Another three-ring binder, unbelievably. The test answers are missing, up at the school. And Joe went there yesterday."
"I didn't even see the answer book," Joe said. "I certainly didn't take it away with me." Reacher asked, "So what exactly did you do up there?" "Nothing in the end. I got as far as the principal's office, and I told the secretary I wanted to talk to the guy about the test. Then I thought better of it and left." "Where was the answer book?"
"On the principal's desk, apparently.
But I never got that far." "You had gone a long time."
"I took a walk."
"Around the school?"
"Partly. And other places."
"Were you in the building across the lunch hour?"
Joe nodded.
"And that's the problem," he said. "That's when they think I took it."
"What's going to happen?"
"It's an honor violation, obviously. I could be excluded for a semester, maybe the whole year. And then they'll hold me back a grade, which will be 2 grades by then. You and I could end up in the same class."
"You could do my homework,"
Reacher said.
"This is not funny,"
Don't worry about it. We'll have moved on by the end of the semester anyway.
Maybe not, their father said. Not if I'm in the brig, or busted back to private, and painting curbstones for the rest of my career. We all could be stuck on Okinawa forever.
And at that point the phone rang again. Their father answered. It was their mother on the line, from Paris, France. Their father forced a bright tone into his voice, and he talked and listened. And then he hung up and relayed the news that their mother had arrived safely, and that old man Moutier wasn't expected to live more than a couple of days, and that their mother was sad about it. Reacher said,
I'm going to the beach.
Chapter 15 Reacher stepped out through the door and glanced toward the sea. The street was empty. No kids. He took a snap decision and detoured to the other side and knocked on Helen's door, the girl he had met the day before. She opened up and saw who it was and crowded out next to him on the stoop and pulled the door all the way closed behind her, like she was keeping him secret, like she was embarrassed by him. She picked up on his feeling and shook her head.
"Then my dad is sleeping," she said. That's all. He sat up and worked all night, and now he's not feeling so hot. He just flaked an hour ago.
Reacher said, You want to go swimming? She glanced down the street, saw no one was there, and said,
Sure. Give me 5 minutes, okay?
She crept back inside, and Reacher turned and watched the street, half hoping that the kid with the boil would come out, and half hoping he wouldn't. He didn't. Then Helen came out again, in a bathing suit under a sundress. She had a towel. They walked down the street together, keeping pace, a foot apart, talking about where they'd lived and the places they'd seen. Helen had moved a lot, but not as much as Reacher. Her dad was a rear echelon guy, not a combat marine, and his postings tended to be longer and more stable. The morning water was colder than it had been the afternoon before, so they got out after 10 minutes or so. Helen let Reacher use her towel, and then they lay on it together in the sun, now just inches apart. She asked him,
Have you ever kissed a girl?
Yes,
he said.
Twice.
The same girl 2 times, or 2 girls once each?
2 girls more than once each.
A lot?
Maybe 4 times each.
Where?
On the mouth.
No, where? In the movies or what?
One in the movies, one in a park.
With tongs?
Yes.
She asked,
Are you good at it?
He said, I don't know.
Will you show me how? I've never done it.
So he leaned up on an elbow and kissed her on the mouth. Her lips were small and mobile, and her tongue was cool and wet. They kept it going for 15 or 20 seconds, and then they broke apart. He asked,
Did you like it?
She said,
Kind of.
Was I good at it?
I don't know. I don't have anything to compare it with.
Well, you were better than the other two I kissed, he said.
Thank you,
she said. But he didn't know what she was thanking him for, the compliment or the trial run. He wasn't sure. Chapter 16 Reacher and Helen walked back together, and they almost made it home. They got within 20 yards of their destination, and then the kid with the boil stepped out of his yard and took up a position in the middle of the road. He was wearing the same core T-shirt and the same pair of ragged pants, and he was alone for the time being. Reacher felt Helen go quiet beside him. She stopped walking, and Reacher stopped a pace